Disc 3. Protecting the developing brain. The placental barrier. It is well recognized that humans, including pregnant women, develop sharp rises in plasma glutamate levels following oral ingestion of MSG. An important question is whether this glutamate can pass through the placenta and enter the baby's circulation. If it can, we know that at certain toxic levels it can damage the baby's immature brain. One study seems to indicate that certain amino acids not only pass through the placenta, but also concentrate on the fetal side of the circulation. This means that the baby is exposed to a higher concentration of the amino acid than the mother. Unfortunately, this study was primarily concerned with the study of the amino acid phenylalanine. But the study did find that all amino acids, including glutamate and glutamine, a precursor of glutamate, were higher in the baby's blood than in the mother's. The highest fetal levels were seen early in the pregnancy, and especially in prematurity. This differential was attributed to lower maternal levels of amino acids, rather than actual elevations of fetal levels. Stejink and co-workers did a more detailed study of glutamate passage across placental barriers and concluded that passage was very unlikely. But upon examination of their results, it becomes obvious that the placenta is not an absolute barrier to glutamate. Yet in this study, when pregnant rhesus monkeys were infused with glutamate in a concentration of 0.4 grams per kilogram body weight, the fetal levels of glutamate rose tenfold above normal. It is also important to note that their study was conducted using monkeys in the last trimester of their pregnancy. Previous studies have shown that the most sensitive time for amino acid transfer across the placenta was earlier in the pregnancy. Others have found that the placental barrier can be overcome simply by giving a large enough dose of glutamate or aspartate, and that this can indeed damage the brain of the fetus. Still other studies have shown that MSG fed to pregnant animals can damage the brains of their offspring. It appears that the placental barrier, like the blood-brain barrier, is not an absolute barrier to the passage of excitotoxins. It should also be remembered that some of the excitotoxins, such as cysteine, can easily pass through the placental barrier and damage the developing brain of the baby. Cysteine compounds are present in hydrolyzed vegetable protein and are being added to some bread doughs. Other factors must also be considered. There are several conditions during which the placental barrier could possibly become incompetent. For example, during periods of fever or viral infections, other barrier systems, such as the blood-brain barrier, can temporarily lose competence. The same must be true of the placental barrier. At times, the placenta becomes partially separated from the uterine wall, again possibly disrupting the barrier. One of the most common lesions affecting the placenta of humans is infarcts. Quite simply, this means strokes of the placenta areas where the blood supply to parts of the placenta have been occluded. This could interrupt any existing barrier mechanism, especially at the margins of the infarct. The placental barrier consists of a single layer of cells, which makes it very delicate and prone to injury. These areas of infarction can vary from small single infarcts, which are seen in virtually all placentas, to multiple infarcts of large size. The number and severity of these infarcts depends on several medical conditions, such as hypertension or diabetes in the mother. There are also conditions in which a person's blood level of glutamate can rise to extremely high levels for prolonged periods of time following MSG ingestion. This could create a situation in which the placental barrier would be breached, thereby exposing the baby to toxic doses of glutamate or aspartate. The developing blood-brain barrier. Many substances considered harmless to the body and found normally in the blood are quite toxic to the brain. This is why the environment of the brain is carefully controlled by a multitude of specially designed protective mechanisms. One of these mechanisms is the blood-brain barrier, whose job it is to exclude harmful substances in the blood from entering the brain. We have learned that several of the amino acids can harm the nervous system, especially the excitotoxic amino acids such as glutamate, aspartate, and cysteine. Under normal conditions, two of these are carefully regulated by the blood-brain barrier, that is, they are excluded from the brain. But not totally. But like the rest of the nervous system, the blood-brain barrier must also be constructed during development. We are not born with an intact and functional blood-brain barrier system. It is known that this protective barrier is incompletely formed in the newborn, and when it reaches a state of full maturity is unknown. There is some evidence that it may not reach complete maturity until adolescence. During this period of growth and development, the nervous system is particularly vulnerable to the damaging effects of a multitude of excitotoxic compounds. Internal development of the brain. Right after birth, a baby's brain is metabolically homogeneous. The biochemical reactions occur evenly throughout the brain. Yet soon after birth, the brain undergoes a period of rapid growth and development, during which time biochemical reactions are separated into special compartments within the brain. During this period, the level of glutamine, a precursor of glutamate, rises very rapidly in some of these compartments. As the brain matures, glutamate levels also rise. And, as we have seen, glutamate plays a vital role in brain development by regulating the wiring of its various components. During this rapid growth phase, the brain grows from 300 grams, two-thirds of a pound, at birth, to 1,250 to 1,500 grams, about 3 pounds, at maturity. By the age of 4, the brain has reached 80% of its adult weight, and by 8 years of age, 90%. At age 16, the brain is full size. But this does not mean that the teenager's brain is fully developed. We know that the organization, reprogramming of circuits, and development of new connections continues for a much longer period, making the teenager potentially vulnerable to the effects of foodborne excitotoxins. As all parents know, it is during these formative years that our children crave junk food, the very type of processed food that contains the highest concentration of excitotoxin taste enhancers. It has been proposed that exposure to excitotoxins, such as glutamate and aspartate, during fetal life may cause alterations in brain development that could later result in such serious brain disorders as autism, learning disorders, hyperactive behavior, and possibly schizophrenia. We have seen that excess glutamate can trigger abnormal nervous system development by interfering with the establishment of proper nerve connections, that is, the wiring of the brain. I have stated earlier that the onset of these behavioral and learning disorders may not show up immediately, but rather may be delayed for many years following birth because of the timing of the onset of specialized brain functions. Injury to the speech areas of the brain, for example, would not be evident in the newborn baby, but would be evident when the child began to learn to speak. Such injuries could result in delayed speech or stuttering. Likewise, damage to areas of the brain concerned with complex learning skills would not be evident until the child started school and was exposed to math and reading. Until that time, the child would be considered to be normal. It is known from experiments that the final effect produced by exposure to excess excitotoxins depends on the timing of the exposure to the toxin. This is because the development of the nervous system goes through a normal sequence of developmental events. The final effect of the exposure depends on what part of the nervous system is undergoing development at the time of exposure. In the instance of other malformation-causing drugs, we know that these drugs do so only if given during critical times of development. In general, the baby's brain is most vulnerable to gross malformations during the first 8 weeks of embryonic development. For example, vitamin A in megadoses can cause serious malformations of the developing brain when given to pregnant mothers during this critical period. It is entirely possible that the blood-brain barrier does not develop and mature at the same rate throughout the brain. Some areas are more likely to mature later than others. There is some experimental evidence that this is true, at least with regard to the hypothalamus. This would mean that the areas with a more immature barrier would be infinitely more susceptible to the effects of excitotoxins in the food, since they could easily enter that portion of the brain. In the case of the hypothalamus, this could result in severe derangements of the endocrine control mechanisms. Indeed, this is what has been seen in a multitude of animal studies. Another protecting mechanism that undergoes gradual development in the embryo is the various cellular pumps that regulate ions and glutamate levels around the neurons. The development of these systems occurs on a microscopic and even a molecular level. These pumps, as we have seen in Chapter 2, are very complex and depend on exact anatomical construction. They are also heavily dependent on energy supplies, primarily from ATP and phosphocreatine. Experimentally, it has been shown that these protective membrane pumps are not fully developed until well after birth. The exact time when they reach full maturity has not been worked out as yet, but it is evident that some of the key enzymes needed to protect the neurons from excess glutamate and aspartate are absent in the immature brain. This is one reason why experimentally the dose of MSG needed to damage the developing nervous system in baby animals is only one-fourth that needed to do damage in adults. Once these protective systems become fully operational, They are very efficient in providing this protection. It is also known that some animals and humans lack these critical enzymes altogether, needed for protection against excitotoxins in the diet. One such enzyme, glutamate dehydrogenase, functions to convert glutamate into a harmless compound. This enzyme has been found to be defective in some human neurodegenerative disorders. Interestingly, when these individuals eat diets containing MSG, their blood levels of glutamate rise much higher than normal persons and remain high for prolonged periods of time. It appears that the defect in this critical enzyme is present from birth. It is also known that others may not lack the enzyme completely, but rather have less of it than other people. Most such individuals would be unaware of their biochemical defect. This would make them more susceptible to food additive excitotoxin exposure as well. Excitotoxins in food and the pregnant woman. Thus far, we have learned that the brain gradually develops important protective mechanisms to guard against the effects of harmful levels of excitotoxic amino acids, and that should these toxic substances get past the brain's protective systems, they can alter the development of the nervous system in important and destructive ways. From experiments, we know that the infant's brain is 4 times more sensitive to excitotoxins than is the adult brain. But what do these excitotoxins actually do to the developing nervous system? Recently, it was found that glutamate can actually activate certain genes. Further, this capacity to activate genes may play an important part in the plasticity of the nervous system, that is, the ability of the nervous system to adapt and change in response to the stimuli of learning and observing the outside world. This is very important, not only in the initial development of the nervous system, while the baby is in the uterus, but also much later, during childhood and adolescence. This is how the various mental and motor skills develop. Learning is a process of absorbing, storing, and analyzing the events about us. This requires a multitude of incredibly complex brain circuits that are much more complex than the most sophisticated computer ever built. But unlike a computer, especially during these early formative years, our brain is constantly growing, reorganizing, and rewiring itself to adapt to new conditions and a flood of incoming data. Glutamate, as we have seen, is one of the more important chemicals playing a role in this developmental rewiring of the brain. That excess glutamate may adversely affect the formation of the brain was shown in 1987 by Dr. Klingberg and co-workers, who studied the behavioral effects of glutamate on brain development. This study indicated that MSG, when given soon after birth, could cause not only significant growth problems, but could also severely affect intellectual development. At about this same time, in another laboratory, other workers found that MSG given to pregnant rats during their last week of pregnancy could damage vital areas of their offspring's brains. Dr. Olney had shown in 1972 that large doses of glutamate given to pregnant rhesus monkeys late in gestation also resulted in damage to the fetus's brains. Adults, including pregnant women, frequently ingest large concentrations of MSG and other excitotoxins in their food. In one study, it was found that some restaurants add as much as 9.9 grams of MSG to a single dish, enough to produce brain damage in experimental animals. Liquids containing MSG, such as soups, are absorbed faster and more completely than solid foods. Experiments have shown that MSG in a liquid form is much more toxic to the brain than when included in solid food. Also, humans have been found to have higher blood levels of glutamate following ingestion of MSG than does any other animal species. Remember, the protective enzymes in the baby's brain are still immature and therefore are unable to detoxify the excitotoxins that enter its brain. This would mean that in the case of pregnant women eating diets high in excitotoxin taste enhancers, the baby could possibly be exposed to these high glutamate levels for many hours. It is not unreasonable to assume that mothers will eat several meals and snacks containing various forms of excitotoxins, such as MSG, hydrolyzed vegetable protein, and aspartame. This could produce a high concentration of glutamate exposure in the baby's brain several times a day. A question frequently asked is whether or not the glutamate enters the baby's brain. While there is no direct evidence in humans, it would be unethical for scientists to conduct such experiments in pregnant women. We do have experimental evidence that it does in animals. Researchers J.H. Thurston and S.K. Warren found that when they treated newborn mice with MSG, their brain glutamate as well as blood glutamate was significantly elevated. Dr. Inouye, in a later experiment, found similar results. In this experiment, he labeled MSG with a radioactive tracer and injected it into newborn mice to study its distribution in the animal's tissues. He used MSG at a dose of 1 milligram per gram, a dose known to produce brain lesions in mice. He found that the MSG reached very high plasma levels within 50 minutes following injection, and then rapidly fell to low levels. But surprisingly, the brain then began to accumulate the MSG, reaching a peak concentration 3 hours after the injection, after which it slowly decreased. He observed an earlier high concentration of the labeled glutamate in the hypothalamus, the hippocampus, the ventricles, and the thalamus. These areas retained the radioactive labeled MSG for 24 hours. It is interesting to note that these are the same areas of the brain known to be damaged by MSG exposure in experimental animals. What this experiment means is that the MSG passes through the immature blood-brain barrier of the mouse and accumulates in certain vulnerable brain regions over a 3-hour period, so that these neurons are exposed to the excitotoxins at a high concentration over prolonged time. In fact, the labeled MSG remained in these brain areas for 24 hours. If the same is true for humans, and it should be, this would mean that the brain could contain high concentrations of glutamate throughout extreme periods of brain hypersensitivity, such as hypoglycemia, fever, or high energy demand. This would throw into question studies that claimed the safety of foodborne excitotoxins based on the idea that blood levels of glutamate fall rapidly following oral ingestion of MSG, since brain levels would continue to rise long after blood levels had returned to normal. A third study, done by Toth and Lajda, confirmed these findings and the principle that the length of exposure to excitotoxic amino acids is very important. Using mice and rats, they found that when given aspartate and glutamate, either as single amino acids or as liquid diets, over a prolonged period of time, from several hours to days, they could significantly elevate brain levels of these supposedly excluded excitotoxins. Aspartic acid, a principal ingredient in aspartame, levels rose as high as 61%, and glutamate rose as high as 35% in brain tissue during prolonged feeding. They concluded that while these excitotoxic amino acids cannot be taken up by the brain rapidly, they can, over a longer period of time, enter the brain in increasing concentrations. Humans are exposed to high concentrations of excitotoxin food additives throughout the day by consuming a variety of processed foods and diet drinks. When the brain tissue of experimental animals exposed to excitotoxins is examined under the microscope, one sees extensive rearrangement of the synapses. The dendrites undergo sprouting and may develop abnormal connections. There is also evidence that immature brain cells exposed to excitotoxins can show a time-dependent loss of the cellular antioxidant glutathione. Remember, it is the antioxidants that protect the cells once the sequence of destructive events is triggered by the excitotoxins. In fact, the antioxidant vitamin E has been shown to significantly block the toxic effect of glutamate in brain cell cultures. While it has not been shown that glutamate and aspartate can penetrate the placental barrier except at high concentrations, we know that there are conditions under which this barrier may be faulty. Besides, until the issues are adequately studied by independent scientists, why risk permanently injuring your baby's brain? Should the developing infant's brain be further assaulted by high levels of glutamate or aspartate, as could occur when its mother consumes foods and drinks high in MSG, aspartate, NutraSweet, and other excitotoxic food additives, these protective mechanisms can be overwhelmed, leaving the brain vulnerable to toxic attack. Newborns, a difficult beginning. Entering the world can be a very traumatic event for a newborn infant, not just because of all the lights, sounds, and occasional pains that come with birth, but rather because for the first time the baby is cut loose from its mother and, at least metabolically, must go it alone. This transition between dependence on its mother's blood supply to independence is especially dangerous because the newborn must supply its own brain with adequate amounts of glucose and oxygen and must be able to remove waste products by way of the blood. This newborn's survivability depends on a strong heart, good lungs, normal red blood cells, and an adequate supply of glucose from the diet. Far too often, one or more of these vital substances are inadequate or even missing. One attempt by doctors to gauge how well the newborn baby was adapting to its new environment was the development of the Apgar score. This score was graded from 1 to 10, with 8 to 10 indicating the best condition and 4 or less signaling severe problems. In-between scores indicate reason for some concern. When not enough oxygen is getting to the brain for prolonged periods of time, severe damage can occur to the nervous system. In fact, oxygen supply must be restored within 5 to 6 minutes to prevent permanent damage under most conditions. Most people are aware that oxygen is vital to the brain, but they are not aware of just how much oxygen the brain consumes. When at rest, the brain uses 20% of all the oxygen in the blood. And when you consider that the brain makes up only 2% of the weight of the body, that's an enormous amount of oxygen. This oxygen is delivered to the brain and spinal cord through miles of blood vessels. Every minute, almost a quart of blood rushes through the brain, carrying oxygen and glucose. Should the blood flow to the newborn's brain be stopped, say by a cardiac arrest, within 1 minute the amount of ATP, the energy molecule in the brain, falls by 80%. Remember, ATP is the primary energy molecule in the brain. After 2 minutes, ATP is only barely detectable. Another condition that robs the brain of its energy is hypoglycemia, or low blood glucose. Normally, the amount of glucose in the blood is fairly constant, but all too often, newborns will suffer from a fall in the amount of glucose in their blood. There are a multitude of reasons for this, such as diarrhea, poor food intake, leucine, an amino acid sensitivity, viral infections, enzyme defects, and even some drugs taken by their mothers that cause hypoglycemia. We often see hypoglycemic babies of diabetic mothers taking anti-diabetic medications. Aspirin can also induce severe, even fatal hypoglycemia in some infants. As with oxygen, the brain consumes enormous amounts of glucose all the time, even when you are in a deep sleep. In fact, the average 3-pound brain consumes about 25% of all the blood's glucose. Unlike other parts of the body, which can use other substances, such as fats and amino acids, the nervous system is dependent on glucose for its energy. It can burn some fats, but not enough to sustain life. All of this energy is used to maintain the various functions of the brain, such as neurotransmitter synthesis and packaging, operation of the various electrolyte pumps, calcium and sodium, intracellular transport of chemicals, and the synthesis of special lipids and other complex molecules used by the brain. But, as we have seen, most important is the use of energy to protect the brain from toxic amino acids, such as glutamate and aspartate, the excitotoxins. Interestingly, the type of neuronal destruction seen when the brain is deprived of oxygen or glucose is very much like that seen when large doses of MSG are fed to experimental animals. But why would a lack of oxygen or glucose cause the same pattern of selective destruction of brain tissue as is seen with a toxin? By the same pattern, I mean the same pattern of cell destruction, with the glutamate receptor neurons being killed and other non-glutamate-type neurons right next to them being unaffected. The answer to this puzzle lies in the protective glutamate and calcium channel pumps that we discussed earlier. Both of these protective membrane pumps are heavily dependent on energy, and when the brain's energy supply is lost, for whatever reason, large amounts of glutamate will begin to rapidly accumulate around the neurons. So, where does this glutamate come from? Most of it pours out of the astrocyte, the glia cells surrounding the neurons, which manufactures glutamate from glutamine. But glutamate can also enter the brain from the diet, especially in the infant, whose blood-brain barrier is still immature and is being fed foods containing large concentrations of excitotoxin taste enhancers, such as MSG. To prove that glutamate accumulation is the cause of brain damage in cases of oxygen deficits and hypoglycemia, neuroscientists next gave such animals a drug known to block the toxic effect of MSG, called MK-801. And, as they suspected, when these treated animals were exposed to hypoxia or hypoglycemia, little brain damage occurred. This means that the brain cells were not dying because they were starving to death, but because glutamate and aspartate were building up in the energy-deprived brain and killing the cells. More and more neurological conditions are being found to be related to excessive excitotoxin exposure, such as hypoglycemia, head injury, migraine headache, seizures, and possibly the neurodegenerative diseases. What all of this means is that newborns often develop periods of hypoglycemia, low blood sugar, and occasionally hypoxia, low blood oxygen, which makes them especially vulnerable to excitotoxins from whatever source. Dr. Vincent Marks and Clifford Rose's monumental book on hypoglycemia lists 44 causes for hypoglycemia in children, some of which frequently go undiagnosed for many years. Prior to the late 1960s, the food industry was regularly adding MSG to baby foods. Based on the growing evidence of MSG toxicity on the brain prior to this period, this exposed these infants to a significant risk of brain damage. The extent of this damage depended on the timing of the exposure as well as the dose, that is, the amount of MSG to which it was exposed. Also of importance is the circumstance under which the child was exposed to these brain toxins. Let's say, for example, a baby is given aspirin for a fever. The baby hasn't been feeling well for several days, and as a result, has eaten poorly. Mom tries to help by feeding the child prepared baby foods. In this case, the aspirin and poor diet will have made the child hypoglycemic. As a result, the baby's brain becomes especially vulnerable to the damaging effects of excitotoxins. The baby food contains MSG, which significantly raises the child's blood level of glutamate. But the child's brain is unable to counteract the high glutamate levels because the energy-dependent protective systems have failed. Remember also, the immature brain is 4 times more sensitive to the damaging effects of excitotoxins, as is the adult, and that following a dose of MSG, the baby's blood level of glutamate may remain high for many hours. Often this damage is subtle and not detected initially, but as the child matures and begins its learning process, these subtle injuries may become more evident. This process may even explain autism and hyperactive behavior, since early excitotoxin exposure may have resulted in a faulty wiring of the developing brain. The extent of this faulty wiring would, again, depend on the timing of the exposure and the dose. If the child is not hypoglycemic or hypoxic at the time of the exposure, the toxic effects would be much less. It also would depend on the status of the child's natural free radical scavengers. For instance, the child might have high vitamin E levels or abundant protective enzymes at the time of MSG exposure. This would greatly reduce the toxic effect. We are all individuals, and some will naturally have more efficient protective mechanisms than others. The problem is we have no way of knowing who possesses abundant natural protective mechanisms and who does not. There are a multitude of variables that determine one's individual sensitivity to excitotoxins, such as age, genetic susceptibility, the total amount of the excitotoxin you are exposed to, frequency of exposure, and the timing of exposure. Even temperature, such as with fever, can activate more receptors on the glutamate-type neurons, making them more susceptible to excitotoxin damage. We also know that excitotoxins have a compounding effect when given together. For example, MSG, aspartate, and hydrolyzed vegetable protein given together in a single meal are much more toxic than when given individually. Many foods contain 2 or more of these excitotoxins. I have seen single frozen diet food dinners that contain MSG, hydrolyzed vegetable protein, and natural flavoring together. Add a diet drink sweetened with NutraSweet, and you have a single meal with 4 known excitotoxins. Remember that hydrolyzed vegetable protein contains very high concentrations of 2 excitotoxins, glutamate and aspartate. Endocrine effects of excitotoxins. Hormones. In 1969, Dr. John Olney demonstrated that newborn mice exposed to high levels of glutamate developed extensive destruction of important groups of neurons in their hypothalamus. The worst damage was seen in the arcuate nucleus of the hypothalamus. This nucleus controls important endocrine functions by regulating the amount of hormone-releasing factors secreted by the hypothalamus and the pituitary. It is also known to control the release of the hormone GHRH, that controls the secretion of growth hormone by the pituitary. Growth hormone is critical in producing growth of the skeleton and other tissues, and in the developing child. Too little hormone results in dwarfism, and too much in gigantism. When these animals were further studied, it was found that MSG could stimulate a wide range of abnormal endocrine responses from the hypothalamus. The release of these hormones by the hypothalamus and pituitary controls the release of hormones from the endocrine glands throughout the body, such as the thyroid gland, the adrenal glands, and the gonads. Researchers found decreased levels of growth hormone, prolactin, and luteinizing hormone in animals exposed to MSG. Normally, even in humans, growth hormone is secreted by the hypothalamus in intermittent pulses. Following MSG exposure, these mice were found to have this pulsatile flow markedly diminished. This phenomenon has now been shown in a multitude of independent studies. Prolactin levels were also found to be decreased following MSG exposure and appeared to be caused by blockage of the normal release mechanisms in the hypothalamus. Prolactin plays an important part in the production of breast milk following birth. Most of these experiments were conducted in newborn animals, but Dr. Shimiku and co-workers demonstrated that when MSG is given to pregnant mice, their offspring also have similar injuries to their hypothalamus. Again, this confirms that glutamate passes across the barrier of the placenta and enters the fetus's bloodstream. With all of these endocrine malfunctions, you would expect these mice to develop abnormally, and they do. Consistently, the animals exposed to MSG were found to be short, grossly obese, and had difficulty with sexual reproduction. One can only wonder if the large number of people having difficulty with obesity in the United States is related to early exposure to food additive excitotoxins, since this obesity is one of the most consistent features of the syndrome. One characteristic of the obesity induced by excitotoxins is that it doesn't appear to depend on food intake. This could explain why some people cannot diet away their obesity. It is ironic that so many people drink soft drinks sweetened with NutraSweet, when aspartate can produce the exact same lesions as glutamate, resulting in gross obesity. The actual extent of MSG-induced obesity in the human population is unknown. It is also possible that many of today's reproductive problems, such as infertility and menstrual disorders, are similarly related to excitotoxin exposure in early life. It has been shown, at least experimentally, that excitotoxins such as MSG and aspartate can cause an early onset of puberty in female rats. This is consistent with the observation that smaller doses of MSG can stimulate the hypothalamus to secrete large amounts of luteinizing hormone, which controls reproduction and onset of puberty. It appears that MSG causes the immature neurons within the hypothalamus to become reorganized so as to disrupt the production and release of these critical reproductive hormones. This again emphasizes that the excitotoxins can adversely affect the development and wiring of the brain in newborns. This adverse effect on reproduction is not limited to females. Researchers have demonstrated a marked reduction of fertility in male rats treated with MSG as well. This does not appear immediately, but rather the effect is delayed until the rats develop sexual maturity. If the same effect occurs in humans, this would mean that with exposure to MSG during the neonatal period, soon after birth, one would not see the adverse reproductive effects of this exposure, such as infertility, until the child also reaches puberty. Pitsy and co-workers found that both male and female mice exposed to MSG early in life developed severe delayed abnormalities of reproduction in adulthood. The females had fewer pregnancies and smaller litters, and the males were significantly less fertile than normal mice. Again, they found that the mice exposed to MSG were obese and had shrunken pituitaries and gonads, testes and ovaries. Similar findings have been seen in all other species of animals tested, which means that the toxic effect of MSG on reproduction is not a peculiarity of mice or rats. So, how would MSG in lower doses cause these devastating endocrine problems? We know that at birth, the arcuate nucleus of the hypothalamus is in a very immature developmental stage, in that its circuits are still being wired. It is these same centers that control the normal release of the hormones that control the reproductive system in both males and females. Based on careful studies conducted in experimental animals, researchers are convinced that MSG, by causing abnormal development of the hypothalamus and damage to specialized neurons, causes the ovaries to become atrophied, shrunken, thus leading to severe problems with the reproductive cycle in females. So it appears that MSG has both direct toxic effects on the nerve cells in the hypothalamus and can cause the organization of the developing brain centers to be miswired. Both of these effects can lead to severe endocrine problems later in life. This is why it is critical that you avoid MSG, aspartate, and other excitotoxic food additives in both your food, especially if you are pregnant, and in your children's food. It has also been found that animals fed large doses of glutamate have lower thyroid hormone levels and higher cortisone levels than normal. Another interesting finding is that glutamate can unmask diabetes in mice that are genetically susceptible to the disease. That is, these mice might never develop full-blown diabetes unless exposed to glutamate. This might explain the high incidence of diabetes in the elderly, since many have had a lifetime exposure to high levels of glutamate. It could, as well, act as a trigger for early-onset diabetes of childhood, which is also hereditary. It certainly is an area that needs further study. We know that children who develop diabetes do inherit a gene for the disorder, but that some, as yet unidentified, environmental event triggers the actual onset of clinical diabetes. While most authorities have assumed the trigger was a virus, it could be an excitotoxin. Do children get enough excitotoxins in their diets to cause problems? One of the big controversies involved in this debate over safety is whether babies and children are exposed to enough excitotoxins in their food and beverages to cause damage to their brains. It is important to remember several things before we begin this discussion. The animal closest to man in glutamate and aspartate sensitivity is the mouse. But even then, man is 5 times more sensitive to these excitotoxins than is the mouse. Humans accumulate glutamate in their bloodstreams following ingestion in much higher levels than do other animals, and it remains at a higher level for a much longer period of time. Together, these two factors, higher blood concentrations and longer duration of brain exposure, make humans much more sensitive to excitotoxin damage than the animals upon which sensitivity studies were originally done. We know that mice will begin to develop brain damage when they are fed monosodium glutamate in a concentration of 500 milligrams per kilogram of body weight. This represents a plasma concentration of 60 to 100 micromoles per deciliter. In adult humans ingesting 200 milligrams per kilogram of MSG, their blood levels reach around 80 micromoles per deciliter, which puts them in the toxic range of known brain damage. One neuroscientist has done a hypothetical dose curve for excitotoxin exposure, glutamate plus aspartate, in a 2-year-old child taking in 200 milligrams per kilogram of these excitotoxins in known food and beverage mixtures. This is based on consuming a reasonable helping of soup and an aspartame sweetened drink. In this instance, the child would receive an excitotoxin dose of 500 micromoles per deciliter, which is 6 times the concentration needed to cause neuron destruction in the hypothalamus of experimental animals. Even using the data from one of the leading defenders of the safety of food additive excitotoxins, Dr. Louis D. Stejink, we see that even when modestly low amounts of MSG and aspartame are consumed, the plasma glutamate rises 5- to 6-fold. This, Dr. Stejink admits, is enough to destroy neurons in the hypothalamus of a mouse. Stejink's data was done on adult humans. We know that the same dose in a 2-year-old child represents an even higher concentration in the plasma. It is not uncommon for adults to consume 10 grams of glutamate per day, with at least 1 gram being free glutamate. Added MSG, aspartate, and other taste-enhancing excitotoxins can drastically increase the levels of free excitotoxins in the average person. If you feed your children off of your plate or let them drink beverages and other foods sweetened with NutraSweet, you may be exposing them to dangerously high concentrations of excitotoxins. The younger the child, the greater the danger. Babies exposed to excess glutamate and aspartate are at particularly high risk. We know that infant animals fed MSG have higher blood levels of glutamate, and these levels stay higher longer than in adults. It has been pointed out that for 20 years prior to 1969, the amount of glutamate added to a single 4.5-ounce jar of baby food contained up to 25 times more free glutamate than could be found in the same amount of mother's milk. This same jar of baby food contained approximately 1/4 the amount of glutamate needed to cause hypothalamic destruction in an infant animal brain. But remember, the human infant is 5 times more sensitive to the same concentration as a mouse. This would mean that human infants could have been damaged by a single jar of this baby food. Truth in the sciences. Not all researchers have confirmed these findings. Soon after this phenomenon was described, some disputed the idea that MSG can cause hypothalamic lesions at all. Dr. Charles B. Nemiroff, who is a primary researcher in this field, has done extensive review of the scientific literature and concludes that most evidence indicates that MSG consistently produces significant injuries to the hypothalamus of a wide variety of animal species and causes disruption of many endocrine hormones. As to the reports that deny such damage, he notes that when he attempted to get samples of MSG-treated animals from these investigators who reported no histologic lesions, quote, "Unfortunately, all such requests have been denied," unquote. But there is even more direct evidence that disrupts these negative claims. Most such negative studies are based on older studies that have relied on light microscopic examination of the hypothalamic tissues of the animals exposed to MSG. The problem with such studies is that they are only able to detect death of the neurons within the hypothalamus and cannot detect less than lethal injury. For example, we know that in some of these negative studies, doses of MSG were used that will damage the functioning of the cells, but will not actually kill them, called a sublethal injury. This cannot be seen through a light microscope. So, how can sublethal damage be detected? One way is to examine the neurons with the electron microscope, so that you can see the minute structures deep inside the cells. Another way is to use radioactive isotopes that will selectively demonstrate damaged neurons, called autoradiography. Dr. W. K. Paul used this technique and found that when MSG was given to newborn animals, it tended to accumulate in the arcuate nucleus of the hypothalamus, which contained the largest population of MSG-sensitive cells. Another method of detecting subtle damage to brain cells is to use special stains that demonstrate enzymes within the tissues, such as peroxidase. Using this method, Dr. W. J. Rietveld and his co-workers observed decreased activity in the cells of the arcuate nucleus in rats treated with MSG. It is thought that this particular enzyme plays an important role in the release of the reproductive hormone LHRH from the hypothalamus. In a separate laboratory, researchers demonstrated a marked loss of cells specifically staining for the hormone ACTH in the hypothalamus of newborn rats exposed to MSG. A more direct method of measuring damage to the neurons secreting these vital hormones in the hypothalamus is to measure the specific levels of the hormone by special assays of the tissues. When this was done, it was found that even in MSG-treated adult animals, there was significantly less of the hormone oxytocin within the nuclei of the hypothalamus than is seen in normal animals. Oxytocin is responsible for the secretion of milk from the breast of females after the birth of their newborns. Some critics of these studies charge that MSG does not enter the brain because of the blood-brain barrier. There are two problems with this argument. First, in the newborn, the blood-brain barrier is incompletely formed and will allow MSG to enter the brain. And second, the hypothalamus, even in the adult, does not have a barrier. That MSG can enter the brain of newborn animals given MSG was shown by two researchers who demonstrated not only high blood levels, but significant elevations of brain glutamate lasting up to 3 hours after the dose was given. This has been confirmed by Dr. Inoue, who demonstrated the passage of radioactively labeled MSG into the neonatal brain following MSG injections. One of the problems in proving that MSG could cause major injuries to the hypothalamus was in explaining how it could injure neurons in this area when so few neurons of the glutamate receptor type were known to exist in this tissue. But then it was only recently that glutamate was found to be the neurotransmitter in the hypothalamus. Using various staining methods, neuroscientists found that glutamate neurons connect to every major nucleus in the hypothalamus. Interestingly, these neurons were found to be sensitive to all glutamate-like compounds, such as NMDA, quisqualate, and kinate, as well as aspartate and MSG. This indicates that a wide range of excitotoxins can destroy and affect these vital neurons in the hypothalamus. What this means is that glutamate-type neurons control every neuroendocrine function of the hypothalamus. This neuroendocrine function is designed to control the thyroid gland, adrenal glands, reproductive functions, gonadal function, body growth, and certain aspects of metabolism. But in addition, glutamate controls all the other functions of the hypothalamus, such as the biological clock, the autonomic nervous system, sleep-wake cycles, hunger and satiety, the emotions of anger and rage, and even consciousness itself. So we see that anything that disrupts or impairs the normal functioning of the hypothalamus can have devastating effects on the organism as a whole. Early exposure in life to high doses of glutamate or other excitotoxins could theoretically produce a whole array of disorders much later in life, such as obesity, impaired growth, endocrine problems, sleep difficulties, emotional problems, including episodic anger, and sexual psychopathology. Whether such changes would be reversible or not depends on the dose of excitotoxin given, the timing of the dose, and how long the child was exposed to high doses of excitotoxins. As for timing, we know that for glutamate, the earlier the exposure to the toxin, the more likely is permanent damage. If exposure is delayed until several years after birth, the injury may be less severe. It is also possible that some neurons are injured but not killed. We know that subtoxic concentrations of glutamate can alter the function of hypothalamic neurons without destroying them. Also, Earlier exposure would increase the likelihood of abnormal wiring of the circuits within the hypothalamus. So, parents, it is important to stop your child's exposure to excitotoxins now. It is important to emphasize that there is ample experimental evidence that glutamate and aspartate both affect the neurological development of the hypothalamus. That is, it alters the way the cells and pathways in the hypothalamus develop. This can result in permanent alteration of the anatomy, as well as the function of this most important brain organ. There is also evidence that MSG acts as a growth factor, as a chemical directly stimulating the growth and maturation of brain cells, thereby acting to alter the development of the brain itself. You should remember, aspartate is also toxic to the hypothalamus. This is probably one of the most common types of exposure seen in pregnant women. Most pregnant women are trying to avoid too great a weight gain, so they figure, I'll cut down on the sugar. That sugar is a major cause of fat gain is a common misconception today. Nonetheless, dieters frequently switch to diet colas and other foods sweetened with NutraSweet. NutraSweet, or aspartame, is a sweetener made from two amino acids, phenylalanine and the excitotoxin aspartate. It should be avoided at all costs. Interestingly, the manufacturer of aspartame warns those with the metabolic disorder phenylketonuria not to drink NutraSweet. In this disorder, there is an abnormal metabolism of the amino acid phenylalanine, so that when it is ingested in the diet, dangerously high blood levels, and hence brain levels, of this toxic amino acid develop. But there is no warning to pregnant women to avoid the aspartate in NutraSweet. When a pregnant woman drinks liquid aspartate, for example in a diet cola, the aspartate enters her bloodstream rapidly, potentially passing through the placenta, where it would flood the developing brain of her baby. Now that we are aware that the brain is extremely sensitive to these substances, avoiding excitotoxins such as NutraSweet, MSG, and hydrolyzed vegetable protein is especially critical. One reason the FDA has not issued a warning is that babies exposed to MSG and NutraSweet are not born obviously deformed, as were those exposed, for example, to the drug thalidomide. The otherwise safe drug thalidomide caused severe deformities of the arms and legs in the offsprings of mothers using the drug early in their pregnancies. Instead, many of these hypothalamic endocrine disorders are subtle and difficult to connect directly to excitotoxin hypothalamic damage, primarily because no one has measured the function of the hypothalamus in children of mothers who were heavy users of excitotoxins during pregnancy. Also, the effects of hypothalamic damage usually do not show up until many years later, even during adulthood, as has been shown experimentally on several occasions. Therefore, a scientifically stringent connection is difficult to make. Conclusion. Thus far, we have reviewed extensive and compelling evidence that excitotoxins can severely affect the development of the brain in experimental animals of all species tested. This sensitivity of the brain varies with the age of the animal at the time of exposure, with the greatest sensitivity occurring while the baby is still in its mother's uterus. At this stage, the brain is very immature, and many of the enzymes and mechanisms that protect the adult brain from high concentrations of excitotoxins have not yet developed. Thus, the baby's brain has no way to protect itself. The transition from a high degree of sensitivity to excitotoxin damage seen in the newborn to a low susceptibility in the adult occurs very gradually over many years. That is, the animal doesn't suddenly, at a particular age, develop all of the protective mechanisms that guard against neuron toxicity. Since this slow transition to full brain protection is seen in all animal species tested, it can be safely assumed to be true in humans as well. This would mean that your child's sensitivity to foodborne excitotoxins would continue for several years after birth, possibly even into adolescence. This has never been tested, so we don't know the exact length of this hypersensitive period. Based on experimental studies in animals, we can reasonably assume that when the pregnant woman eats or drinks foods containing high doses of excitotoxins, such as MSG, hydrolyzed vegetable protein, and NutraSweet, her baby's brain is at potential risk of being exposed to these excitotoxins. This, especially if the exposure continues day after day for 9 months, could lead to significant damage to the child's hypothalamus as well as other areas of the brain. We have seen that the hypothalamus plays a vital role in controlling a multitude of endocrine systems and physiological functions, and that this damage can either be quite subtle or, at times, devastating. In either case, the onset is often delayed years or even decades. We have also seen that excitotoxins can potentially lead to severe misdevelopment of other parts of the brain, possibly leading to learning disorders, autism, and serious psychological problems. This has been suggested in experimental studies, but as yet there is no firm proof of the connection in humans. You must keep in mind that all of these excitotoxin food additives serve only one purpose. They enhance the taste of food. They are not preservatives that keep food from spoiling, and they have no nutritional value. Potato chips, frozen foods, diet foods, soups, and gravies almost all depend on excitotoxic taste enhancers. Chapter 5. Creeping Death, the Neurodegenerative Diseases. Neurological time bombs. Most of us are at least familiar with some of the diseases that affect the brain and spinal cord. For example, you can understand how a virus might invade the brain and cause it to become inflamed, called encephalitis, or when a bacteria infects the linings of the brain and spinal cord to produce meningitis. Likewise, it is easy to understand, at least in a basic way, how the brain is injured by a stroke. But sometimes the brain is injured in more subtle and mysterious ways. For example, with Huntington's disease, a specialized group of brain cells may begin to die and shrivel up, causing uncontrollable writhing movements and dementia. In another instance with Parkinson's disease, different brain cells in another location may begin to die, producing a fine tremor of the hands and rigid, plastic-like movements of the body parts. When the loss of these specialized cells is more widespread, such as in Alzheimer's disease, it may lead to severe dementia and disorientation. What characterizes all of these diseases is that they develop in previously normal brains and progress, in most instances, very slowly, causing the brain and/or spinal cord to degenerate eventually. A multitude of these degenerative diseases are known to exist, including amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, olivopontocerebellar degeneration, Alzheimer's disease, Huntington's disease, and Pick's disease. What is so unusual about these diseases is that most of the people who are affected by them have lived perfectly healthy lives up until the time the disease strikes, which is usually late in life. After the onset of symptoms, the signs and symptoms of the disease inexorably progress over the ensuing years, or even decades, until the individual is crippled. The puzzle of what causes these particular neurons to start dying after decades of normal function has intrigued neuroscientists for many years. Until recently, one of the more interesting theories was based on the idea that these neurons age faster than normal neurons, and that this premature aging is programmed in the genetic structure of the cells. This means that some neurons would be programmed to live only 55 years, rather than the normal 100-plus years. This idea was popularized by a famous neurologist, W.R. Gowers, at the turn of the 20th century. He called this process abiotrophy. But then evidence began to appear indicating that even though the symptoms do not appear until the later years, the pathological destruction of the neurons begins much earlier, even decades earlier. As we shall see later, the symptoms of Parkinson's disease do not manifest themselves until over 80 to 90% of the neurons in the involved nuclei, called the substantia nigra, have died. The neurons didn't all suddenly die at the same time. Rather, they slowly and silently deteriorated over many years. The same is true for Alzheimer's disease. This is why prevention is so important. What is causing these neurons to slowly die? Why are only certain neurons susceptible to this death, while neighboring neurons remain perfectly healthy? We know that some viruses can cause neurons to die slowly. Scientists have renamed these slow viruses prions. But so far, an intensive search for these prions has failed to make the connection with the major neurodegenerative diseases. Also, most of the prion diseases have much shorter durations. Other scientists are of the opinion that malfunctions of the immune system are the cause of many of these diseases. This is particularly so with Alzheimer's disease. This theory is based on the idea that occasionally the immune system gets confused and accidentally attacks the nervous system, or parts of it. There are diseases where this happens, for example, allergic encephalomyelitis, a disease in which the immune system mistakenly attacks the nervous system. Yet, thus far, the results of extensive studies of such a connection to the neurodegenerative diseases are not that impressive. The most impressive line of investigation is the possibility of an environmental toxin as the causative factor. While most attention has been directed toward the metal aluminum, there are problems with this theory, as we shall see. But first, let us explore other possibilities, namely plant toxins. The environmental connection. The mystery of the Chamorro Indians. As American troops invaded the islands of Guam following World War II, the military doctors were astounded to find that large numbers of the Chamorro Indians living on the Mariana Islands were dying of a mysterious disease that left the Indians too weak to stand or even swallow their food. Their bodies were horribly wasted. Later, when other research doctors returned to the islands, they discovered that the mysterious disorder closely resembled another disease seen in the West called amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS. What made this finding so incredible was that the incidence of the disease on these islands was 50 to 100 times higher than ALS seen in the developed countries. Obviously, something very strange was going on. Scientists who came to study this mysterious disease knew that the people had suffered terrible hardships and famine during the war. But famine and stress were common in all wars, yet this clustering of such a rare disease had never before been seen. In the United States and Europe, ALS has a frequency of 1 or 2 cases per 100,000. Clinically, the disease is identical to that seen in Guam, with progressive weakness, usually beginning in the hands, spreading up the shoulders, and finally involving all 4 limbs. Death usually follows 3 to 5 years of an inexorable progression of severe weakness and wasting of the muscles. The mind stays perfectly lucid throughout the entire course of the disease. The National Institutes of Health has been studying the cause of this clustering of ALS in Guam for the past 30 years. In fact, they set up a field office in Guam specifically for this purpose. Initially, they felt that the high incidence was caused by a genetic defect that was being compounded by tribal intermarriage within this isolated group of natives. But further study discounted this hypothesis. Others investigated a viral cause, but this too was disproven. In 1954, epidemiologists studying the disease discovered that the natives frequently consumed large amounts of a particular plant called Cycas circinalis, or cycad, during the war years. Actually, cycad, made from the false sago palm, had been eaten by the natives for centuries. In fact, the Indians knew the plant was poisonous, and for that reason they developed a ritual to render it safe for eating. This process consisted of soaking the sliced seeds in water for several hours. This was repeated several times, each time using fresh water. After the last soaking, a chicken was fed some of the wash water. If it lived, the seed was deemed safe to eat. Once made safe, the seeds were then ground into a flour, or sometimes it was used to make a medicinal poultice. During the war years, because of the famine, cycad flour made up a large portion of the natives' diet. Unfortunately, fresh water was also in short supply. As a result, the natives often abbreviated the washing technique, and sometimes they abandoned the chicken test. Often, the natives made the flour for barter rather than personal consumption, so they used shortcuts which often eliminated the washing altogether. When the scientists analyzed the seed, they found that it contained various glycoside compounds, the most important of which was cycasin, a known liver toxin. Cycasin was also found to induce cancer in rats. But multiple attempts to induce the ALS disorder in experimental animals failed. Later, another toxic compound was found in smaller concentrations. This compound, called beta-N-methylamino-L-alanine, or LBMAA for short, was found to cause seizures when fed to mice, but was not shown to cause the muscle wasting seen in human cases. The idea that cycad flour contained a toxin that was causing the disorder seemed obvious to early investigators. Over the years, between 1962 and 1972, a series of cycad conferences were set up by the National Institutes of Health. At one of these conferences, evidence was presented demonstrating that LBMAA did not cause the ALS disease when fed to rats in large doses for 78 days. This report almost killed further investigations of cycad for good. But one researcher, Dr. George Spencer, found that LBMAA had some properties that were similar to another compound he had been working with, called LBOAA, which caused a spinal cord disease in humans called latharism. Latharism is a disorder that is characterized by the sudden onset of weakness or paralysis in the legs, following consumption of diets high in the chickling pea, Lathyrus sativus. In the late 1970s, Dr. Spencer met another researcher, Dr. Leonard Kurland, who was working on the Guam ALS disease and its connection to the cycad seed. From this meeting, they immediately recognized the distinct possibility that both diseases could be caused by a related plant toxin. One phenomenon they both noticed was that the Guam ALS disease was often delayed for many years following ingestion of the seed. Spencer toyed with the idea that this might represent a chronic toxic effect. Then, in 1980, Dr. R.M. Goruto and his co-workers studied a group of immigrants from the high-risk area of Guam who had moved to the United States as young men and women. They found that even though these immigrants had been separated from the toxin for over 30 years, they still suffered from a high incidence of ALS. Somehow, the toxin had a delayed effect. As the scientists and doctors continued to study the Indians living on these southern islands of Guam, they discovered that many also suffered from other neurological diseases that, strangely enough, had characteristics of two other degenerative neurological disorders occurring in the West, Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's-like dementia. They named this new disease Parkinson's Dementia Complex of Guam. Some patients had features of all three diseases combined: ALS, Parkinson's disease, and dementia. Clinically, all of these diseases are exactly like those seen in the United States and Europe, but pathologically, there were differences. Most important, all of the Guamian patients had extensive neuritic plaques and neurofibrillary tangles scattered throughout their brains and spinal cords. These are microscopic clumps of degenerating material, usually seen with Alzheimer's disease. In fact, they discovered that even the Indians that were free of symptoms had numerous plaques and tangles in their nervous systems. Spencer, while searching the research literature on cycad, found a most interesting report that had apparently been overlooked and since buried in the research literature. It was a report of a single monkey fed a concentrated solution of LBMAA for several weeks. The animal developed the same disease seen in the natives on Guam, as well as having the identical pathological changes in its spinal cord and brain. He repeated the experiment, this time using 13 monkeys. After 2 to 12 weeks of feeding the animals a concentrated solution of LBMAA, they began to show signs of severe weakness in their limbs, and, as with the human cases of ALS, it affected the hands first and then spread to involve all of the limbs. When he examined their spinal cords, he found the characteristic degeneration of the anterior motor cells, which control motor movement in the extremities. This is the same microscopic picture observed in human cases of ALS throughout the world. But then something strange happened, which would forever change our thinking regarding toxins and neurological diseases. He found that if he continued feeding the animals the LBMAA beyond 13 weeks, they began to develop a shuffling gait, assumed a blank stare, and a mask-like expression on their face. It was the exact picture of Parkinson's disease as seen in human cases. For the time, it was demonstrated that the final disease produced by exposure to a certain neurotoxin depended on the length of time an organism was exposed to that toxin. Spencer concluded that acute high-dose exposure to LBMAA resulted in ALS, and that more chronic exposure produced Parkinson's disease and possibly dementia, at least in monkeys. But why did the immigrants from Guam develop ALS after being away from the toxin for 30 years? Actually, the incidence, at 10 to 15 times the U.S. rate, was less than that seen in those who continued to eat cycad flour. Did the toxins sit quietly in the neurons and then decades later suddenly become activated and kill these same neurons in the spinal cord? Not necessarily. There is another possible explanation. Remember, I said that clinical symptoms of a degenerative neurological disease do not present until 80 to 90% of the specific cells involved are dead. It may be that the cycad exposure during their youth killed off, say, 50% of the anterior horn cells, which would leave them clinically unaffected or minimally affected. Once these immigrants moved to the United States, they were exposed to other foodborne excitotoxins, such as MSG, hydrolyzed vegetable protein, cysteine, and aspartate. These are less potent excitotoxins than LBMAA, but chronic exposure of these already weakened neurons to excitotoxins could lead to a gradual lethal injury to the remaining cells. Once 80 to 90% of the motor neurons were killed, symptoms of ALS would appear. Then why wouldn't all of the Guamians develop ALS, since they had all been exposed to the toxin in the flour? Because, as you will recall, everyone has a different sensitivity to these toxins. Some are extremely sensitive, and others are quite resistant. There is a lot of individual variability in toxin sensitivity. Resistance can depend on the protective mechanisms within the brain, the blood-brain barrier, the ionic and glutamate pumps, and the free radical scavengers. Those with strong protective mechanisms would be less likely to develop the disease. Also, dietary exposure to excitotoxins varies considerably. those people who eat many foods containing MSG and hydrolyzed vegetable protein would be at greatest risk. Another factor would be the efficiency of the energy metabolism in their neurons. Remember, essentially all of the protective mechanisms depend heavily on energy availability in the brain and spinal cord. For example, those suffering from bouts of hypoglycemia or who frequently go on low-calorie diets could possibly be at high risk for developing the disease. Excessive physical stress, such as hard physical labor or exercise, heat stroke, and illness, would also add to the pre-existing damage. There are a multitude of variables to explain why some develop the disease and others are spared. More evidence. Actually, Guam is not the only place where high concentrations of these diseases have been found. In fact, there are three distinct geographical areas of unusually high incidence of these neurological disorders: the Chamorros of Guam, the Ayu and Jikai people of West New Guinea, and the Japanese of the Hobara and Kozagawa districts on the Kii Peninsula of Honshu Island. The incidence of these diseases on the Kii Peninsula is 25 to 100 times that of the rest of Japan. Both of these locations are in remote, mountainous regions, essentially cut off from the rest of Japan. On the southern island of West Guinea, we find a very high incidence of all three of these diseases among the Ayu and Jikai people. Interestingly, neither increased incidences of ALS nor Parkinsonism are found in the surrounding larger populations outside this region. Both high-incidence groups live on diets consisting of large amounts of sago flour. The overall incidence of ALS among these people is 147 per 100,000 population. This is 150 times higher than that found in the United States or Europe. It is the highest incidence of these diseases in the entire world. In some villages, the incidence is 1,300 cases per 100,000 population. Characteristic of all these areas of high disease incidence is a diet consisting primarily of carbohydrates derived from cycad flour. The higher the intake, the higher the incidence and severity of the disease. Magnesium, calcium, and aluminum. One of the prevailing theories of the cause of Alzheimer's disease is a chronic exposure to aluminum. This idea was given a boost when doctors observed a dementia-like illness in certain kidney dialysis patients. When these patients were studied, it was found that they had very high levels of aluminum in their tissues. Later, it was discovered that the water used to dialyze these patients also contained high concentrations of aluminum. The incidence of this disorder fell dramatically once the aluminum was removed from the dialysis medium. When the microscopic plaques taken from the brains of Alzheimer's patients are examined, they are found to contain rather high concentrations of aluminum. From this observation, it was hypothesized that aluminum directly damaged the neurons. Immediately, doctors began to examine foods for excess aluminum content. Many foods and condiments contain aluminum. Table salt contains aluminum, as do some flours. Usually, these aluminum salts are more absorbable than metallic aluminum. Once this became general knowledge, a scare was launched among the public. Cookingware, soda cans, and even roll-on deodorants became suspect. But there was a problem with this theory. Aluminum does not selectively kill the same neurons destroyed by Alzheimer's disease. When scientists studied the soil of the various regions with a high incidence of these neurological diseases, they found high levels of aluminum and low levels of magnesium and calcium. Yet when the neurons from victims of the disease were also examined, they found high levels of calcium and aluminum and low levels of magnesium. The most consistent finding in all of these areas is a low magnesium level in the soil and water, as well as in the neurons of victims of these diseases. On the island of Guam, they found that areas with the lowest levels of calcium and magnesium were also the areas of highest incidence for all of the neurological diseases. If we go back to what we learned about the glutamate receptor mechanism in Chapter 3, we see that magnesium plays a vital role in protecting the neuron from the lethal effects of excitotoxins. Remember, the lethal mechanism with NMDA receptors involves the rapid influx of calcium into the cell. It is this rush of calcium into the cell that triggers the series of destructive reactions that cause the cell to be injured or killed. Experimentally, neurons are much more vulnerable to the effects of excitotoxins when magnesium is low. This is because magnesium normally blocks the calcium channel. In the cases of cycad toxicity, we see that the neuron contains low concentrations of magnesium and high concentrations of calcium within the cell. Such a condition would leave the neuron maximally susceptible to the toxic effects of excitotoxins. When rats are placed on diets low in calcium and magnesium, they develop swelling and calcium accumulation in the anterior motor neurons of the spinal cord, the same cells destroyed in cases of ALS. But if dietary calcium is low, as was found in all of these areas, how can calcium accumulate inside the neuron? It is because the neuron always takes precedence over the body's use of calcium for other purposes. When the calcium channels are opened, calcium will pour in, no matter the blood's concentration of the element. The other condition causing extreme vulnerability to excitotoxins met in each of these areas was a low availability of foodstuffs, in this case caused by famine. Food was scarce during the war, and this led to low energy caloric intake. We have seen that the mechanisms that protect the brain from excess excitotoxin accumulation are heavily dependent on cellular energy. Experimental studies have clearly shown that low energy levels greatly enhance the toxicity of all classes of excitotoxins. When magnesium deficiency is combined with low energy levels, maximum vulnerability is seen. Even small doses of excitotoxins can produce damage otherwise seen only with massive doses of the toxin. It is known that low dietary calcium can cause the parathyroid glands to malfunction. These are small glands located in the neck, next to the thyroid gland, that control calcium metabolism in the body, including its absorption from the gut. When calcium levels are low, the parathyroid glands secrete more hormones, thereby increasing calcium absorption from the gut. But, unfortunately, it also increases the absorption of aluminum, which accumulates in certain regions of the brain. It may be that aluminum acts as a cotoxin in these diseases, adding to the toxicity produced by excitotoxins. When monkeys are fed diets low in calcium and magnesium, but high in aluminum lactate, they become very apathetic and begin to lose weight. When their spinal cords are examined under the microscope, they show swelling of the anterior motor cells, plus accumulation of calcium and aluminum in these cells. We can conclude from this that the two conditions which increase the sensitivity of the nervous system to foodborne excitotoxins include low energy availability and low magnesium levels in the brain and spinal cord. Under such conditions, maximum sensitivity and therefore vulnerability to excitotoxins exist. Designer drugs, the big surprise. In 1982, a bright young man, whom we shall call Tom, with a taste for the bliss of heroin, decided that he could produce a similar drug in his own home laboratory for a lot less money than the cost of street drugs. The drug he sought to make was a simple opiate-like compound called MPPP. After mixing a few basic chemicals in a beaker, he filled a syringe with his concoction and deftly slid the needle into a large vein in his forearm. The drug burned momentarily as it rushed into his bloodstream. As Tom sat on the side of the bed waiting for the drug to take effect, he noticed that his vision had begun to blur. He eased himself back down onto the bed, but nothing seemed to be happening. After another hour, he decided that somehow he had mixed the drug improperly. The next morning, Tom was awakened abruptly by an uncontrollable shaking of his body. A metallic taste stung his tongue. Then, without warning, his legs and arms began to jerk. He tried to rise up from the bed, but his limbs felt as heavy as lead. Tom felt a rush of fear grip his heart. "Something is wrong," he told himself. He struggled out of the bed and made his way to the mirror. As he stared at his reflection, he tried to speak, but his lips moved in silence. He struggled harder, but he remained mute. Tom convinced himself that it would pass with time. The next day, he continued to feel the jerking and shaking of his limbs, and it was all he could do to speak. His mind raced with fear. "I just need more time," he reassured himself. "It will get better." That afternoon, a friend dropped by to see Tom. As he entered the darkened bedroom, he found his friend lying in bed, staring straight at the ceiling. He shook his friend gently by the shoulder. "Tom," he called out, but Tom didn't move. His friend called an ambulance, which then rushed Tom to a local emergency room. The doctors hovering around Tom were baffled. They had never seen anything like this. Nothing they knew of could leave a young man alert, yet unable to speak or move his limbs. His arms and legs were as stiff as boards. They called in a neurologist for help. The neurologist performed a thorough examination and then turned to his colleagues and stated that Tom had all of the findings of a patient with advanced Parkinson's disease. But no one had ever seen a case of sudden Parkinson's disease, especially in someone so young. Most such advanced cases occurred only after years or even decades of slow progression. But in Tom's case, the disorder appeared suddenly and with a vengeance. For the next 2 weeks, his condition continued to deteriorate. The only way he could communicate with his doctors was by blinking his eyes with a code for yes and no. He drooled continuously. The neurologist, knowing that L-DOPA was the drug of choice for Parkinsonism, decided to try it on the unfortunate young man. After a week on the drug, there was a slight improvement. But soon Tom began to deteriorate again, and remained severely crippled by his self-induced disease. What is usually found at an autopsy in the typical Parkinson's patient is the destruction of a particular nucleus found in the brainstem called the substantia nigra. These darkly stained nuclei contain high concentrations of a pigment known as melanin. In Parkinson's disease, these cells die and release their pigment. But there is one critical difference between experimentally produced Parkinsonism, produced by MPTP, and that of the typical Parkinson's patient. There are no Lewy bodies. These are microscopic collections of debris seen in the neurons of the brain nucleus damaged in Parkinson's disease, the substantia nigra. But even without them, the clinical picture in Tom's case was typical of Parkinson's disease of the elderly. Apparently, Lewy bodies, like the tangles and plaques of Alzheimer's disease, do not cause the disease, but merely reflect damage done by the disease.